The Buddhist Society Summer School, 1977. The Aryan Silence Course. Preliminary Lecture and Example of Walking Meditation by Firoz Mehta on Saturday morning, the 27th of August.
It came to me during the night and more towards the early hours of the morning that there was considerable disturbance in the minds of some members of the group here. Considerable reaction against a certain degree of fear, even resentment, because of the silence, the discipline of the silence. We may not be aware of it consciously, but in all of us, the mind is not a unified whole. So we have this common distinction between the conscious mind and the subconscious or unconscious or whatever you like to call it. And there are repressions in every one of us because of our upbringing, our socio-cultural heritage. That's from the outside. And from within ourselves, these are determined by our natural, as we call them, natural likes and dislikes and so forth. Do not be upset at my saying this. This is how we are. Here in the waking state, the conscious mind may say, we are all friends. I have no antipathy or resentment against anybody. But in the deeps of the unconscious, and there are all these other forces also at work. The demons of hell are not confined to hell. The angels of heaven are not restricted to the boundaries of heaven. They interplay. These demons and angels are names for various aspects of our mental functioning, what we commonly call our mental functioning. Our own aspiration, which of necessity are self-centered at our stage, up to a point at least, when we start the earnest practice of the Buddha, Dhamma, and so forth. Our very aspirations towards what we call the highest are forces to stir up the demons. And also to obstruct, prevent the angels. The obstructive or destructive forces on the one hand, the constructive forces which bring to fruition on the other hand. As we become more sensitive, we can see this not only in ourselves, but sense it as it goes on in those around us, those associated with us. So when I say it came to me during the night that there was this fear, resentment, upset, the feeling, oh, I cannot possibly stand this. Just see it calmly, as calmly as possible. Take it for granted. If I have a pimple on my nose, there's no point in being upset about it. Apply the right ointment. That's all. Now you see, we who belong to what we call civilized societies repress a great deal. And we desire to achieve and to attain what the intellect frames as good, worthy, and so forth. But the intellect is the slave of desire. Not only the conscious desires, but all the hidden, repressed, secret desires. Hence, during sleep particularly, these come up to the surface. You know, whenever they tell ghost stories or anything like that, they are always having their fun and games during the dark. To the coming of the light, off they go. Where to? Back into the well of the unconscious. And the lid is put on. But if one is sensitive, it is always light. Whether on earth there is sunshine or the sun is shining on the other side of the globe. So we must just learn to take this in our stride. But there is the work of preparation beforehand. To be able to deal with these subtle forces, and still more so, to deal with the great archetypal energies that function right through our world, whether we know them or not. In order to deal with them rightly, there is a very simple preparation work. Again, it is related to mindfulness. And where did the Buddha start his mindfulness? Simply and straightforwardly with the things of this world. What you see, what you hear, what you taste, what you smell, and so forth. Now, one of the very important points which we miss out in our efforts and actions is this. We don't recognize that the psychophysical organism is made up of all these energies concretized in the body and having more subtle form and expression in terms of our thoughts and feelings. And particularly in the case of those of us who live in cities and under present world conditions which we cannot control or stand at the moment, we are under appalling stress and strain. With the world as it is, there is the compulsion of circumstance constantly upon us. Especially under these conditions and in this state of affairs, we are unawake to the fact that the organism is made up of the same elements as all nature itself. Nature is the mother of all manifestation. She is the sustainer. She is the one who takes us all back into herself in the vast and marvelous process of the universal becoming. We are out of tune with nature. We run back to our mother in terms of a holiday in the country for peace and quiet, don't we? We run back to mother in the mountains and the lakes and the streams and the sea and whatnot. But we do not know how to be gracious unto mother, to be well-mannered, well-behaved with mother, and not to forget mother when we are away from mother in the midst of this stress and strain. So the Buddha taught simple things like walking mindfully, breathing mindfully, eating mindfully, and so forth. These are all acts of communion. The acts of communion will necessarily go on because a living body must necessarily eat, drink, walk, etc. But we are unawake inside our own organisms. The senses see, the eyes see, the ears hear, and so forth. But how do we see here? In terms of a truly loving relationship with the mother of all things, of a true rapport, we don't. So the Buddha taught to observe mindfully all the time. And you all know about the practice of walking mindfully. But as it is presented in the texts you have, I am taking a long step, taking a short step, etc. I am putting my foot down and so forth. But as far as I'm aware, the texts miss out a very important point. Instead of regarding it in terms of I am doing this, I am doing that, because the emphasis on the I constantly separates us from the totality. One must be aware in terms of this is happening. This is being done. And although you, the specific you, are doing it, it is in fact an activity of you and the total environment in which you are absolutely contained. If the environment suddenly disappeared, every one of us would be dead as a dodo straight away. You think it out. There is no possibility of existence apart from totality. It is totality which exists. So let us not think in terms of I am doing this, I am doing that. Let us walk mindfully awake to the relationship with all the elements of nature. The old people talked of it as earth, air, fire, water. In modern language, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and all the rest of it, you see. Electrical forces, heat, light energy, gravitational energy, all these things. The mother draws every one of us to her. It's the gravitative pull of the earth that keeps us with mother. Supposing the gravitative pull suddenly disappeared, what on earth? Well, it would be on earth, it would be up in the air. There might not even be air. In fact, there wouldn't if the gravitative pull disappeared. The molecules of air would run off in every direction. The school bell has rung for the last time, and hurrah, shout the kids as they go scuttling home. Be awake. And the more we realize aloneness in the midst of the totality and in complete relationship with the totality, the more we realize that aloneness, the more selfless we are. And loneliness and all its horrors are wiped out. So, this meditative walking, it will very simply be along these lines. We shall just walk out together and be awake to our relationship with the ground on which we walk, the grass, the trees, the colors, the clouds, the sky. Now, when you look, see it both objectively and subjectively. Don't let us cut ourselves out. I am looking at a cloud. There is a looking in which these eyes and that cloud are in the foreground. But be awake to the fact, the reality of the background also. Be awake to this totality. When you are awake to the totality, all resentment against anything disappears. It is there. All egocentric, vain ambition disappears. There is Everest. I am going to climb it. And the journalist asks, why do you go mountain climbing? Oh, because it is there. And I am going to climb it to make it a here. How ridiculous. In mind and consciousness, everything is in the here now. So you see, all the flaws, the defilements of the mind, as the Buddha called them, they all dissolve away. Actually, they change in the dissolution. It is like dissolving, then the energy holds only up to a point, not completely. It's like dissolving, say, crude sugar, or salt, which has a lot of bits of grit or something, in water, filtering it, and all that is not wanted is left behind, and the pure solution comes, and you recrystallize the pure stuff. But where the analogy fails is that there is no separating here. There is the transforming of the unwanted stuff. This is the difference. You see? It is a little bit like this. It is not I who do anything. It is not I who call upon. Now, when the sort of meditation extends to things like that, it is not I who call upon and summon the transcendental forces, these archetypal energies. It is somewhat like this. We are like coachmen with so many coaches, each of us driving a coach. We are all the king's coachmen. We can't shout to the king, "Hi, king, come into my coach." The next thing that will happen is that your head will be rolled off by the king's orders for such impertinence. You just wait. His Majesty appears and chooses his coach. Transcendence is His Majesty. Quite a different approach, isn't it? So I don't have to fight against my selfness. Transcendence sweetly and freely does the work if I just cease to obstruct. So now, let us go out. Is it warm enough, or shall I bring a coat? Right. I have to breathe this.
Now follows an exercise in walking meditation.
Quite near the trunks, big trunks of trees. Can you sense the rising of the sap? You will actually physically feel it. Right near, and quite still and quiet. That is important. This is where it is difficult with a group together. But when you are alone, or just two or three, you stand quite quietly. And you will become aware of this rising upwards of life, this life force, up beyond the trees, interacting with the subtler forces of space, coming, functioning back through one's own brain and nervous system. And the whole circuit is completed thereby. Some of you may have actually experienced this, that in times of distress, deep distress, poignant something very poignant has happened. And you just lean against that tree, and your breath rhythm becomes your natural life rhythm, and you just feel healed, although the brain doesn't know how or why. But this is how it is. The subtle forces are at play. And because the poignancy of the experience has been so great, oneself has given up struggling. You give up the struggle. And in the giving up of the struggle,
Then the mother takes you into her arms. Underneath are the everlasting arms. Don't seek consolation from others or from art or any sort of beauty as such. Don't seek it like that. Or from religious texts and so forth. If we learn by just being mindful and awake to the pain and the sorrow, then that pain and sorrow have been the blessings bestowed upon us from on high. And it is because the great seers and mystics knew all this through experience, they declared that the supreme gift of God is death. Death, the great transformative power, never to go back into the old confinement. And that death takes place every moment of our lives. And if we are awake to it, the fear of death goes. When the fear of death goes, greed, hate, delusion, all those easily go. This is very little known or understood. What starts our greed? Food, from the time we are born. The infant suckling at its mother's breast. Look at it. Its whole consciousness and its organism is completely involved in that suckling of the mother's breast. And if the mother takes it off just a moment too soon, the reaction, resentment, hate, anger. So you see, eating and drinking, feeding ourselves, is the root source of that. And similarly, we try to feed ourselves on spiritual reality and spiritual truth. And that also becomes another source of trouble. Similarly. But when we are adult, we can understand these things. A little baby has a brain box, but it is not yet. The current is not on, so to say, yet. It's just beginning to learn. Now you see why eating in silence has a profound significance. Eat quietly, slowly, mindfully, and you are restoring to nature, to Mother Nature, as richly as Mother Nature is giving to us. It's an act of grace. It's a graciousness. It's very interesting to look at people around one, as they, so many of them, gobble their food. Look at it, violently done, graspingly done, in great haste, and they eat vast quantities. Isn't that so? If you eat mindfully, you savor the food. The Buddha himself, in more than one discourse, says, when people ask him, "But do you, venerable sir, or however they really, eat nicely prepared curries and so forth?" They imagine that he ill-treats the body by eating food which is awful or something. And the Buddha very quietly tells them, but I, and he uses the word I, aham, but I savor the curry, I take a bowl full of rice and curry. The suggestion is that he enjoys it. But an enlightened one knows the meaning of enjoyment and the technique of enjoyment. We don't. It's all these little things which make up the sum total of our daily life become religious living if we just let the senses function properly. And if we are awake and the brain is quiet, then you will actually know, not in so many words, the words are not necessary, you will just know that it is through your eyes and ears and so forth that transcendence sees and hears its own beauty and music and marvel. So you become the living vehicle of transcendence itself, as the great teachers were. And then another marvelous thing that happens is that you cease to compare. These people have nearly an arhat's ideal, but these people have the bodhisattva ideal. But if you look at the Buddha's autobiographical discourses, you find him saying, whilst I was still the bodhisattva, he was in such and such a stage. And then at last, realizing nibbana, the uttermost security from the bond, he realized nibbana, and thenceforward he calls himself arahant. Araham bhikkhave, he says to them, not bodhisattva. Very interesting.